The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to the show. Tonight I'm going to be stirring it up with my guest, Nicholas Pearson, and it's really, really going to be interesting. Nicholas has been, as some of you may not know, immersed in all aspects of the mineral kingdom for more than 20 years, and he's written several books devoted to stones and crystals, and that's what we usually talk about when he's here. We're talking about a book. But tonight we're taking a different route, actually, because Nicholas suggested that we do a show about crystal myths and misconceptions, fake stones, and mistaken identities. And I think a lot of people have been duped and didn't know it, and people are making money off of those things. So, chat room, if you have any questions for Nicholas as we go, just send me a message in private chat. And those of you who are outside the chat room, you'll have to come over to ParaXRadioNetwork.com and join us. And in the meantime, let's get started. So, Nicholas, hi, and welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back on. I'm grateful no one is sick of me yet. I think this is like 10 shows we've done together.
Well, I don't look at numbers very often, but mostly you're one of the top five people. I mean, out of, you know, hundreds that people want back and people listen to the podcast and everything else. So I don't think anybody's going to get sick and tired of you anytime soon.
Well, good, because I'm not sick and tired of being here.
Well, good. Yeah, it's nice and comfy. It's kind of like an old shoe now, which makes it even better, you know?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, aside from the fact that the topic that you suggested we talk about rang a bell to me, because a while back I wanted to get some hematite, I never pronounced that right, and I was looking on the web, and I saw all different shapes and sizes, and some were loose stones, and others were claimed to be magnetized, and there were magnetized bracelets and all that, and they all looked like hematite, and I thought that's what it was. But I did a Google search just to see what the difference was between the regular tumbled stones, and I learned that the magnetized ones were actually totally man-made, geologists don't actually consider the man-made magnet stuff as hematite. And since it's technically just defined powdered iron oxide that's kind of heated and granulated, see, I did my homework, then, you know, it became a magnet. So let's talk a little bit about the difference between like treated, enhanced, synthetics, and simulated gemstones, and start wherever you want.
Sure. Well, I mean, congrats to doing that research. That's like such a wormhole to get lost in. It can be really daunting because you find so many conflicting stories about the origins of rocks and things that resemble rocks. Mm-hmm. So I think it's helpful to define some of those terms, you know, right off the gate. So, you know, we're using terms like treated, simulated, synthesized, and so on and so forth. So a treated stone typically is any natural stone that has gone through some process by human hands to enhance it, maybe to change its color or to make it more durable or to, take away certain optical effects that can make it hard to cut and facet. treating gemstones is something that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and there are still some treatments in use today that resemble the ones the ancient Greeks and ancient Egyptians used. So they kind of run the full spectrum. Synthesized stones are stones that are identical to what happens in nature, except we made them in a laboratory. So this is kind of like the quartz that's in our watches, or the corundum or sapphire crystals that are in our phones. You know, when they first introduced the thumbprint ID on the iPhone and other devices, the thing you placed your thumb on was a little bit of corundum, and lots of watch faces are also made out of corundum. So, you know, it has the same physical, chemical, optical, structural, I mean, all the stuff about it is the same except where it came from. And it, when we make things in a lab, they tend to be a lot more pure as well. And then we run into this territory of simulated stones. Now, simulant means that it looks like something else. So this could be, you know, green stripy resin that simulates malachite but doesn't contain any. It could be something like a natural material that simulates the effect of diamond if cut and treated in the right way. Or it could be a synthetic stone or other thing that is made in a laboratory that resembles a diamond when it's cut and processed in the right way. So simulated stones are kind of like an even bigger umbrella, because it's not just things grown in labs. It's not just things that have a chemically similar makeup, but they can be all sorts of things. Resin and glass and bits of rock that are ground up and put together, and plastic. I mean, so many things can be simulated.
Yeah.
So since it's a wide umbrella term, no two materials are necessarily the same. And it can be hard to know what is real and what isn't. So in the case of the hematite you talked about, we would call that a simulant. And the chemical name for that kind of substance is called ferrite. So it's still an iron oxide, but it has a slightly different chemical composition and a different crystal structure. So it's still crystalline. Even though it's made from a powder, it has like these little tiny crystal particles, much in the way that hematite has little tiny crystal particles. But, you know, it's brittle. It can be magnetized. It has some similar optical and physical properties, making it hard for the layperson to tell the difference. But here's a big one. If it's magnetic, it's not hematite.
Yeah, that's what I got out of it. And I it's a good thing I didn't buy them. But, you know, these large sellers like Amazon, for example, in fact, that's where I saw it, apparently, or I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but they probably don't verify authenticity in the stones, or not all the stones anyway, that they purchase for resale, right?
You know, I think most of the time in the retail setting, people do the best they can with the tools they've got. They have to rely upon their suppliers being honest. And sometimes their suppliers aren't even well informed.
Right.
I visit a lot of wholesale and like trade show kind of events. And, you know, these wholesalers are people who are not necessarily always metaphysically inclined. Some of them just like rocks. Some of them think they're beautiful. Some are really interested in the scientific part. And others, of course, are into the healy-feely, witchy, mojo kind of stuff. So it's again, a pretty broad spectrum. And lots of times they're getting things by giant industrial barrel full and then polishing them. And so provenance, history, origin, it all gets lost. And that includes the not so authentic stuff. It's easy to have that slip through the cracks because things are happening in such great big quantities that nobody's keeping track of the fine details.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because I think we talked about when I was going to try and do a book that had some stones in it, you know, a booklet that also had a box full of stones. And I know that Pete Schiffer always went over to China to get stones and things like that. And I don't know that it was because they were better quality or maybe they were better fakes. I don't know, you know, but it seems like a lot of people go out of the country to get things when they need it in very large quantities. But did that make a difference?
I would say part of that is just virtue of that's where the work is done. That's where things are cut and polished. That's where they're being tumbled by the truckload. There are places like South Africa and Brazil and China and India that do a lot of the lapidary work that the rest of the world sees for these sort of semi-precious and common stones. There's still, of course, other lots and lots of other places in the world where lapidary work is done, but I would say that the majority of all tumbled stones that you can find in your average metaphysical store or body, mind, spirit show, they're probably getting tumbled in places like that because that's just where it's convenient and economical to do it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what are some of the common treatments like used for crystals and gemstones? And do they have any effect on the energy of the stones?
Oh, yeah. Great question. So, you know, it's staggering to think about this. But more than 80% of all the gemstones used in the jewelry industry, and that's not just the woo-woo jewelry industry, but all jewelry ever that contains gemstones, more than 80% of them are treated or enhanced in some way. Mm-hmm. So that's the vast majority. And sometimes those treatments are really mild. Things like heat treating, stabilizing. Some of them are, we'll say, a little more drastic, like irradiation and dyeing. So, mm-hmm. you know, heat treatment is just what it sounds like. If you heat up a rock, sometimes the color changes, the clarity improves. There are all sorts of reasons that you might do this. You can change some amethyst into citrine by heating it. You can change other amethyst into praseolite, which is a green quartz, if you heat it. Mm-hmm. Something like aquamarine, most of the gem quality aqua that's used in the jewelry trade is heated to improve the color and even it out. But even common rocks, simple things like carnelian, are at the very least heat treated to make their color more even and to take out the pale color bands that are in there. So go for
it. Yeah, you just reminded me of peacock ore. Now, is that when it's raw, it's not nearly as beautiful as when it's tumbled, but is peacock ore generally kind of pretty anyway, or have they really made it like the peacock, you know?
So two different minerals get called peacock ore, and there are probably others, I'm sure. Mm. But the two main ones are chalcopyrite and bornite. Bornite is not, we'll say, very, it's not as stable as chalcopyrite. It's also not as abundant. But when these two minerals oxidize, they take on that really vibrant peacocky, you know, color combination, those mm-hmm. brilliant blues and greens and golds and all that fun stuff. Yeah. So when most of the stuff is freshly mined from the earth, it's like a dull metallic kind of sheen, and a mm-hmm. quick dip in an acid bath will give us that brilliant set of hues. So there's a treatment that's done just to speed up a natural process. So mm-hmm. I consider that kind of acid washing identical to what's happening in the earth. We're just making it happen instantly. So there's no significant change in the energy. But if we do something like take clear quartz and bombard it with radioactive energy, it darkens. And that's a really drastic process. And that can render a stone, we'll say, not of therapeutic inclination. That doesn't mean you can't mm-hmm. enjoy it. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. it might not have some sort of magical, spiritual kind of lesson that it's going to offer you, but I mm-hmm. wouldn't take an irradiated gemstone and lay it on the body of a client. In theory, it shouldn't have much, if any, background radiation left by the time it comes to market. Mm-hmm. But I'm reminded of a time, maybe around a decade ago, when virtually all blue topaz was recalled on the U.S. market because nobody had been checking the radioactive half-life of the gems. Mm-hmm. And nearly all blue topaz is colored by irradiation because it's cheaper, it's faster, it's more efficient, and you can produce much better colors than Mother Earth tends to. And they just weren't being quarantined for long enough to make sure that they were not dangerous. So that's one kind of treatment I don't generally like to work with. Some stones are dyed. I don't use gemstones therapeutically if they've been dyed, because mm-hmm. it's kind of like gumming up the works, like all the pores have been clogged up. And then stabilizing is another one, which can be really helpful for soft porous stones like turquoise. Nearly mm-hmm. all turquoise is kind of crumbly when it comes out of the earth, so it'll mm-hmm. get stabilized with paraffin or resin or plastic or other things just to make sure that it stays together. Sometimes it's a thin coat on the surface, sometimes it's deeply impregnated with it. But the sneaky thing is, one of the ways that they will improve the look of turquoise and therefore drive up its value artificially is while stabilizing it, they can also introduce dyes. And then you end up with a stone that is both dyed and stabilized. And if you were to split it open, you'd see it was not the same color all the way through.
Okay, so when you're putting things in my head now, you're driving me crazy in a good way. so if we get a raw stone, I mean, it looks, it's porous, it's rough, it's, you know, the way it is. And you get a tumbled stone and it looks shiny and it doesn't look like it can breathe, if that's the right terminology. So aren't tumbled stones maybe less powerful than raw stones because of that polishing and, you know, it looks like it's got clear polish all over it?
So the way they achieve that is just by successively finer abrasives. And Mother Earth does the same thing with stones that we pull out of the river that have no sharp edges on them. And it's also how grains of sand get to be so tiny. It's just successively finer and finer abrasion that, that gives us that bright, shiny polish. Some things do get lacquered. Some things are stabilized in that way that can kind of gum up the works. But all other things being equal, no other treatments involved, a rough stone and a tumbled stone are going to more or less give us the same energy, as long as they're of equal mass, color, clarity, quality, they're free of other things going on inside them, then we'll get more or less the same effect. One might feel a little softer or smoother, but they'll still yield the same energy.
Okay, because now I'm suspicious of every tumbled stone I have, I swear. And also some of the other ones that are really bright colored, the raw ones. But I have a question for Mufi in the chat room. And she said, should we feel guilty about the mass digging up of stones when we buy them?
Well, this is heavy stuff. I want to start by saying, first and foremost, I hope no one ever makes you feel guilty for a decision you were uninformed about. You know, when we know better, we do better, period, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the ethics and mining, this is an ongoing conversation I'm seeing happening more and more and more. Now, frankly, most of the rocks that we get in the crystal healing industry are byproducts of other kinds of mining. They're what we call gangue minerals, G-A-N-G-U-E. And so they're the less valuable stuff that forms around ore deposits. So if someone is going to the Democratic Republic of the Congo to get some really valuable cobalt and tantalum and other like hard to find things, they have to dig other stuff out of the way. So out comes all this beautiful chrysocolla and shatterkite and malachite and these other gorgeous, gorgeous things, because they're not valuable on this particular mission. So what ends up happening is those things which are already dug out of the earth and left piled up as tailings from the mine, they might actually yield pollution. They get cut and polished and sold on the market to people like us who are not interested in buying tantalum and niobium and cobalt and all this other fun stuff.
Right.
So I think on one level, there's a certain amount of necessity is the mother of invention, right? There's a certain amount of demand on the market that is fulfilled by this byproduct of mining. And so the production and sale and consumption of crystal healing materials generally is not what's producing the greatest environmental, social, and ethical demands on the market.
Okay.
Could it stand to be better? Absolutely. But, you know, the devices that I'm talking to you on right now have more impactful things socially and environmentally than any piece of rose quartz you're going to find on the market.
Well, there you go. And it's kind of like recycling in a way, right?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, not everything comes that route, but a surprising amount does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's a great answer. That was a good question. So what are some of the most common faked and simulated stones?
Ooh, this one's great. So I would say, like, you stroll into your average metaphysical store, you're going to see some things that I think the average consumer knows are not Mother Earth grown, but not everyone does. So opalite is a really good example, which often gets passed off as natural opal or natural moonstone, but it is in fact a man-made glass.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of brightly colored glasses that get called obsidian and quartz. Here's a good rule of thumb. If the kind of quartz you're buying has an exotic fruit in the name, it might not be quartz. This is not a hard and fast rule. You can find strawberry quartz that is actually quartz. You can find something they call mango quartz that has these brilliant orangey-yellow halloisite inclusions. But, you know, if you see cherry quartz and blueberry quartz and pineapple quartz, referring to the color of the material, it's a good chance it's colored glass. Another thing that I see really rampant on the market is fake malachite. And people go to great lengths to try to justify it, saying, well, there's ground up malachite in it. But there isn't. I've examined this myself. Malachite is a carbonate mineral, so it would fizz if we put a little acid on. These things don't do that. It doesn't have the density to contain real malachite in there anywhere. So just stripy resin. Of course, lots of other kinds of quartzes can be either grown in labs or cut and polished from blocks of glass. But another material I'm seeing with increasing frequency as being faked on the market is moldavite. Now, the last year has seen an extraordinary increase in demand for moldavite, but I recently came to learn that not a single new piece has been mined commercially for almost 18 months now. So this actually precedes coronavirus and its impact on the global economy. Mm-hmm. There were lots of internal factors, seasonality. I mean, you can't mine when the ground is frozen solid. That's something to consider as well. The Czech government has really declared it a precious substance and is limiting the export. So no new moldavite is hitting the market. Mm-hmm. Well, I should say, no new authentic moldavite is in the market, but there are so many pieces that are made from finely etched bits of glass or poured resin. That's, you know, they make these really clever molds, but you know, that's something that I would say when the moldavite craze reached fever pitch, I was probably running into at least one person a week who was showing me a piece of what they thought was moldavite, but was in fact not.
Mm. You know, I was just going to ask you a question about price being a factor as a way of sniffing out fakes from the true stones. But then, as I'm thinking again, and maybe because, you know, the people that are making things up in the labs and everything, it may be not cost effective for them to do that, to sell what they're making at a cheap price. So maybe people who are paying top dollar for supposedly authentic, beautiful stones are probably paying the same amount for fakes because they got to get their money's worth too, right?
Sometimes I see the price run the full spectrum. I mean, I've seen people ask ridiculous prices, like the valuation is absurd, even for natural counterparts. And then, you know, I also see a moldavite pendant with a stone as big as my thumb that if it were natural would be, you know, $700 or $800 on today's market that someone bought online for $30. I mean, big red flag. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And that's not just with rocks, that's with everything. If it's too good to be true, we got to stop and think about it and go, all right, if I'm out $30 for a cool piece of resin, is that going to break the bank? For me, no, personally, it's not. But you know what I'd rather do? Just not buy a cool piece of resin. So I'll spend that $30 on something I know is real, even if it's not moldavite.
Yeah. All right. We got a good question in the chat room. Can fake stones have the same effects on people that believe they are real?
So I think there are two things we want to address in this question. Can the fake stones have effects? I mean, if they're truly simulated and not a synthetic, you know, counterpart, and so it's not the same chemical composition, crystal structure, and all that jazz, the stone itself is not going to do it. So, like, here's a really good example. We're going to use a piece of opalite and a piece of moonstone. And vaguely, you know, especially if you have a good enough moonstone, the two are going to look kind of similar, especially from a distance. One is amorphous silica. It's glass, very low mineral content, no real vibrations that it's producing. I mean, no different than the vibrations of your windows. They're useful, but again, I don't place those on my client's body. And the other one has a very unique chemical composition, unique optical properties that produce the Schiller or iridescence in it, all sorts of other factors that make it like a very specific substance with very specific energies. So fundamentally, the vibrations from these two things are going to be very, very different. But here's something, the other part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
Belief. The human mind can do a lot. So will the stone affect the change if it's not really a stone? No, probably not. But can the human mind do it? Sure. But the human mind could also do it with a bottle cap if you believe that bottle cap was going to help you. And if that's the route you're going, then let's just skip the tool and use the mind to do it. And then don't worry about the fake, right? So
True. Yeah. Although people do need tools because, you know, they don't trust their minds well enough. They have to have something in their hands that's tangible to give them some courage, I guess, sometimes.
For sure. Yeah. And if you've got the right tool, it does that work so much better. So, you know, in this example of something with no crystal structure whatsoever, you know, glass is an insulator. It's not going to project energy the way something like moonstone would. So they have very different material properties, but that also kind of translates to the immaterial. So if we work with that piece of glass, sure, if we believe in it hard enough, change is going to happen. But if I work with that natural crystal, it is going to amp up the power of my mind and do so, so much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So are there like instances of widespread cases of mistaken identities of crystals and gemstones?
Oh, yeah. There's actually one that's kind of waning in popularity in the market right now, only because there's no new mining of it being done. Sadly, the mine is not currently being worked at all, but it's this blue stripy material that they call scheelite, except it's not the mineral scheelite. The mineral scheelite is the principal ore of a rare metal called tungsten. We use that in a bunch of technological applications, inside filaments, inside our light bulbs. I mean, it's a valuable thing. It's also crazy heavy, and it fluoresces very brilliantly. And if you look at all the physical properties of this blue stripy stuff, it's the wrong color, it doesn't form discrete crystals, it's nowhere close to the density or hardness of actual scheelite. Some specimens will fluoresce under the right conditions, none of mine do. And while it's a beautiful material, it's definitely not scheelite. Another really common one that I come up against almost on a weekly basis is people who want to buy something called azezchulite. Mm-hmm. And you know, here's the funny thing behind azezchulite. It's cheap quartz. That's it. There's nothing special about it chemically, physically, structurally, mechanically, electromagnetically. There's nothing unique about its makeup, except its name got trademarked with a made-up New Agey-sounding word, and you can charge 1,000 times what someone might sell it to you as just low-quality white quartz.
Wow.
And the gentleman who owns the copyright to this miraculously always finds azezchulite no matter where he's traveling in the world. It's almost as if you can pick up any rock and call it azezchulite. So, yeah, and it's just insane. Like, you can buy maybe a 4 or 5 inch sphere of this material for $2,000. I could pick up a 4 inch rock of white quartz on a hike for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and quartz is around more than people think. I mean, you know, I showed you a couple things because I was digging around in the yard and it looked like there was quartz running through some of these rocks, and that's what they were, river rocks. But so, yeah, and I suppose, you know, if I was clever, I could chip the quartz out of there and have a little stone. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, some things you don't have to pay great a deal amount of money. You just have to keep your eyes open and kind of know what you're looking for.
Exactly.
And sometimes you can get some really strange, wonderful things. We're getting ready to take a short break, and that's good because I've been sitting here eyeballing some of my stones, just wondering now, you know, did I get rooked or not? And so I think this is a good time for people to maybe, in the 2 minutes we'll be gone, grab some of your crystals, because when we come back, I think Nicholas has some very practical advice on how to identify your stones and crystals and separate the fake from the true. So, yeah, we'll be back in 2 minutes and have a crystal or two in your hand.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also
has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from schifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
You've no doubt heard of Tango and Cash, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, perhaps It Takes Two to Tango. Well now, on the first and third Thursdays of each month, there's a show called Tango and Friends at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network with your host, Bruce Tango. And yes, there will be at least two to tango on each episode, sometimes even more. There's going to be lots of topics and lots of guests you'll all know and lots of surprises. Tango and Friends, every first and third Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hi, and we're back with Nicholas Pearson, and we're talking about crystal myths and misconceptions and fake stones and mistaken identities. And as we went to the break, I mentioned that Nicholas is going to have some good advice on how to identify our rocks and our minerals from the good, the chaff, and the whatever. I forget that saying, but you know what I mean. So, Nicholas, jump in, and how can we tell if what we've got in our hands is real or not?
So, you know, if we're specifically looking for, is it a nature-grown stone versus a not-so-nature-grown stone, there might be a few clear tells, but there are also a lot of things that are going to depend on the mineral species or the rock variety that we have in our hands. So, like, the qualities we look for in natural amethyst are very different to the qualities we might look for in a diamond or a piece of jasper or a piece of calcite. So I think the first thing you can do is look at lots of rocks. It's a great homework assignment. Like, dig through your collection, open up a book, scroll through the internet, go visit your local rock shop or gem and mineral show, and just touch as many rocks as you can, within reason, of course. And, you know, start to, like, pay attention to more than just color and shape. Like, what other things can you discern? You're going to notice textures that emerge. If you examine a piece of lapis lazuli well enough, you notice that the calcite and the pyrite that are swirling inside it are probably in foliate bands, whether that's really discrete lines or more diffuse bands. You start to see the pattern emerge over time. So just handle as many rocks as you can, because over time you're going to know, oh gosh, this is not a piece of quartz. Look inside. There are these spherical bubbles. It's obviously a piece of glass. If we're using, you know, quartz is the example here. One of the great things that we can do is the temperature of quartz is going to be very different to the apparent temperature of something like resin or glass. It will feel much cooler in most circumstances. It will maintain a steadier temperature even as the environment around it changes temperature. Although small pieces of quartz do heat up pretty quickly to body temp when being held in the hands. So it's not an absolute kind of test, but that's one little thing we can look for. And there are also certain tests that we can do at home that give us an idea of what something is made out of. So maybe we've determined this is a real rock. I know that by the way it looks and feels. I trust the source it came from as being genuine, and they told me it was a real stone, but maybe I'm not sure which stone it really is. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things that we can do at home that are super easy and also kind of fun. So the first one is what we call a hardness test. If you are enough of a rock hound, you're probably familiar with what they call the Mohs scale of hardness. It's named after Friedrich Mohs, and he took 10 representations in the mineral kingdom that were all stronger or less strong than one another. And he ranked them out. So, you know, at the very bottom, we have talc, which is super soft. And then we have gypsum, which is a 2. And then you've got calcite at 3 and fluorite at 4 and apatite at 5 and so on and so forth. And we put diamond at the top, which is 10. So, you know, your fingernail is about a 2.5 on the hardness scale. So it'll scratch anything with a hardness scale of 2 or below. A piece of quartz ranges from about 6.5 to 7 in most cases, sometimes even a little bit stronger. And it'll scratch the majority of things that are, you know, 6 or below. So you can pick up a rock that you know. Maybe you have a piece of apatite, it's got a sharp corner on it. You know it's a 5 on the hardness scale. Scratch this mystery rock. Does the apatite leave a mark, or does it not hold up to whatever this material it is? That'll tell you if it's harder than or softer than, and then you kind of like play with it and go, well, I know steel has this hardness, I know copper is this hardness, let me try scratching it with ordinary household objects or other rocks. And that's such a great way, because it starts getting your brain to think like a scientist instead of, you know, just someone who's an appreciator. You start to go, I know the relationship between these two things says this one should be harder and this one should be softer. Let's test that. And try it with something you already know the answer to and make sure that holds up. And then try with things you don't know. So that's a great way, because you can always look up the hardness of things. And if you're sold something that should be very, very hard and it turns out to be very, very soft, you can eliminate a lot of the possibilities. Another one that rock hounds like to do is called a streak test. And this one does require some equipment, but I promise you it's not at all sophisticated. So all you need is a piece of unglazed tile. Most people use white. If you have a light-colored one and a dark-colored one at the same time, it shows off a little bit better. Some will appear more readily on a dark background. But a streak test is done when you take a piece of rock or mineral and you just scrape it against some unglazed porcelain. And the dust it leaves behind can be a clue to what it is. Mm. So a lot of minerals produce what's called a white or colorless streak. I take a piece of quartz and I, you know, scrape it on some unglazed porcelain. The streak has no color. Now, it could be smoky quartz, black, and I still get a white streak. It could be amethyst, which is deep, dark purple, still get a white streak. I could do a piece of agate, which is cryptocrystalline quartz, in virtually any color of the rainbow, and still getting a white streak. So other things, especially the metallic looking stones, things like hematite, pyrite, covellite, galena, they're going to produce some pretty interesting streak colors as we grind them up. So hematite leaves a red streak. That's one of the telltale signs. You have a piece of hematite and you've got this shiny metallic looking rock. You're not sure which shiny metallic looking rock it is. You scrape it, you know, blood red powder comes off. You probably have hematite. Could be a few other things, but it does narrow down the playing field really well. Some of them are surprising too, like pyrite, shiny bright gold leaves a black streak. So sometimes we see that relationship and it's a great way to know. And every now and then I get a mystery rock and I'm like, oh, is this cuprite? Is this hematite? Is this cobaltite? All I know is it's heavy, it's metallic. Let's go see what color streak it is. And so that's a really fun thing you can do. It's not a sophisticated test either.
No, but it's interesting that that you can do it, and you can kind of figure out what's going on with things, because there's a right and a wrong to everything. I was just trying to find that big, huge piece of, oh my God, obsidian that I have, and because it's chipped. I mean, it's chipped all over the place, you know. And at first I thought, well, this is something fake because it should be black inside too, but it really isn't. It's that glass inside, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that just made me realize that, yeah, okay, it's true. It's real. does the quality of a true stone make a difference in the quality of maybe the spell or the healing that it's being used for?
I like to think so, and here's why. If the model we're using to describe crystals comes from, if the model we're using to describe how crystals works comes from its It's crystalline makeup, the chemical composition, the crystal structure, the formation process, then the more pure and perfect the manifestation of those qualities, then the more pure and perfect the manifestation of its energy. It's like having a very clear signal versus a really muddy one if we have one that's a lower quality. But that's not the only model for describing how and why crystals work. We can't only focus on that and then forget the fact that stones have consciousness. I have met many, what you might call an ugly rock, that was a powerful healing stone because of the consciousness, the soul, the spirit, the spark of divinity within that stone just shone so brilliantly, no matter how humble the stone, that it really did some amazing work. So all other things being equal, quality does give us a pretty clear, we'll say, idea of the intensity of the energy. Same music being played, but maybe the speakers are just clearer on one example versus the other. But there are other factors that can be part of that too. I wear some pretty ordinary rocks every day. I have I wear a bracelet of round beads that are granite, humble granite, because granite is such a powerful healing stone.
Yeah.
And this granite happens to come from a very special place to me. But at the end of the day, a geologist would look at it and go, "You're wearing granite." I would say, "Yes, absolutely I am. And isn't that great?"
Yeah, that's funny. Because some people wear things just to show off, and some people actually wear them for the right reasons. So, yeah. In the chat room, Cece just put a question. She said, "So then would the quality of the crystal or obsidian be a factor in scrying?"
I think this is one of those things where it's not only the electromagnetics involved in the stone that makes it a good scrying vessel. Part of it is the aesthetics, and so that's really subjective. What I find useful, helpful, and valuable in my scrying practice might not be what someone else does. One of my teachers in this realm always preferred a really cloudy sphere of quartz to a very clear one because it gave you something to focus on as you were gazing into it. I have known other scryers that almost refuse to work with clear quartz because they can't afford one that is clear enough and large enough for what they want to do. So they use fused silica glass, what they sometimes sell as reconstituted quartz. I've got news for you, though. You can't reconstitute quartz unless you're growing new crystals from it. If you melt it down, it's no longer quartz. But because the material body of the object is all they're interested in, is it clear enough? Then that's something that matters to them. So as far as is the quality a factor in your scrying? Absolutely, but this is totally subjective. So you get to decide what is the best quality for you.
Yeah, because if you believe in it, like we talked a little bit about earlier, it's going to work better for you, you know?
For sure.
All right. So how about telling us a little bit about the trend in renaming stones? Like, you gave a few examples already. I mean, how does this affect the market and the greater crystal healing, occult, magical community kind of thing?
Oh, there are so many ways we could go with this. You know, first and foremost, it is not new to give a stone a misleading name. The jewelry industry has been doing this for centuries. If you buy a piece of Madeira topaz, you have some heat-treated citrine instead of a beautiful topaz.
Wow.
If you look at, like, the Black Prince's ruby, it's actually red spinel. In fact, a long-standing name for the gemstone spinel is Ballas ruby. And because rubies are valuable, they kind of ride that wave. I mean, these days, gem quality spinel is rare and valuable, but that wasn't always the case. So renaming stones is not entirely a new phenomenon, but the way it's happening now is being done in such a way to make pretty ordinary rocks appeal to the metaphysical and spiritual market in ways that they probably wouldn't have been popular before. So I mentioned azezchile. That's one of the really widespread ones, but that's certainly not the only example. You've got this stuff coming out of coming from out west, and it's basically a pegmatite, which is like a fancy granite. If granite had even more time to cool very slowly, it would form even larger crystalline components. So a lot of like gem quality things come out of pegmatites. And this stuff is being called euphorolite because a lot of people have euphoric experiences working with it. Now it's a small claim. There's only one source for it. There's only one person who owns the land. So there's not a lot of material out there. As it gets more popular, I've seen the price go up, but just calling it euphorolite isn't necessarily the reason. It gets more expensive. Although trying to sell someone, you know, lithium-bearing pegmatite doesn't sound super woo-woo. And so that's kind of an idea that we have to settle with. Like the geological names for things are not always interesting to lay people. And so I'm not necessarily anti-trade names. I'm just anti-deceptive trade names that are intentionally used to obscure facts about a crystal. Because, you know, in the azezulite example, you can go out and find amazez or amethyst azezulite, and the material written about it, the official description, describes it as being found on an island, a remote island off the coast of Africa, or a remote island in the Indian Ocean, which is code for Madagascar. And if someone just tells you that this is, you know, what we call amazez, is chevron amethyst from Madagascar, you would go, okay, great. I'm going to go buy a piece of chevron amethyst from Madagascar for like $15 instead of spending $200 on your stone that is exactly the same. So it's arriving at a place where the renaming and rebranding of common stones is inflating the value so greatly, and people who are not, we'll say, geologically inclined aren't able to know if they're being had. And it's so sad to me because I look at a beautiful rock and I go, oh, isn't that a really great granite? Oh, wait, you want how much money for a piece of granite? No, thank you. But not everyone thinks with the brain of a geologist. And like, let's be real, I am not a credentialed geologist. I never got a degree on that route. I have a lot of hands-on experience with rocks, including in the science field, but a proper geologist I am not. So it's kind of murky waters out there. But the thing I'm noticing is as these things like guardianite and azezulite and helirite and euphorolite and all these things that sound like made up names, because they are getting more popular, it kind of reflects poorly on the rest of the community, because the sciencey people go, oh, well, I mean, these woo-woo people, they'll buy anything. And then we can't be trusted. We don't get invited to the same events. We don't get to have meaningful conversations with people, even though at the end of the day, we're all interested in the same thing. We all like rocks. It's hard to be taken seriously. And I think it does a detriment to the whole community, because I do believe there is potential for studying the effects of crystal healing. I do believe that there is a sort of a magic as well as a metaphysical or even physical principle that we can one day map out and identify. But as long as we've got people who are intentionally hiding what the origins, the makeup, the real nature of rocks are to make money, then it hurts us all. And a hidden factor of this is if we don't know what something really is and where it really comes from, we don't know how safe it is. Is this something that I should wear? Is this something I should put in my water? Chances are, if you're asking that question, you should not put it in your water. Just when in doubt, leave it out. If I don't know the source of this, do I know what kind of impact it's had on the environment? Do I know how the people who mined it were treated? Do I know what the conditions were like for the people cutting and polishing it? Absolutely, you don't know any of those things. And you can probably just assume the worst. So it's a fine line to walk. The ethics of the market are more than just, was this rock dug out of the earth respectfully? And was the person who did that work paid fairly? You may never have the answers to those things, but there are other red flags of unethical practices and processes. And that's in the marketing, in the distribution, in the consumption of it. So we have to start looking at the bigger picture if we really want to create lasting change, and if we want to create a system that supports us with these tools that are just meant to do that, support us, we have to be honest. And I'm hoping more of us will start asking those questions, and more of us will go, hey, this beautiful thing is maybe a little too beautiful and too good of a price. I'm going to see if this is the real deal. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But we don't know unless we start contemplating those things.
Good. That's food for thought. All right, so I have another food for thought question. Mufi wants to know, how can a mirror rock fix your liver, protect you, calm you, be good for your heart? Because if you read the metaphysical properties of a stone, they do everything but do the dishes.
This is a really great question. And I think the real question is, how and why do we expect to achieve any of those results? And just having a mirror rock in your pocket doesn't solve any problems whatsoever, unless the problem is your pocket was empty. Easy fix. But, you know, the real work comes from our conscious and intentional partnership with that stone, that crystal, that catalyst for change. It's like having a gym membership. I can go buy a gym membership and nothing about my body will change unless I go to the gym regularly, consistently, unless I push myself, unless I'm willing to be uncomfortable and achieve a new level of being. And it's the same with our rocks. You can get that beautiful piece of amethyst to try to create some serenity in your life. But if you never sit down and meditate with it, if you never cleanse that crystal, if you never program that crystal, if you never engage in a real meaningful relationship, you don't get anything out of it. So sure, the power of the mind is a big component, but it's like the rudder that steers the ship. If you never have that conscious mental relationship with your stone, then the ship isn't going anywhere. So I think there's so much more to it than just the power of the mind, but that's the only part of the equation you control. So why not use it to its fullest potential?
And she said that was a very good answer, so this is good. Now, Cece has a question that's kind of off topic, but it was interesting to me. She said, so crystal head vodka is filtered over hexamer diamonds. Would that really help?
I mean, it probably wouldn't do any help in the filtration process. I think, if I'm being maybe too transparent here, I think it's a really great gimmick. This vodka was triple filtered through Herkimer diamonds and then bottled in a beautiful hand-glown glass skull bottle. I mean, if I were a vodka person still, I'd be a sucker, right? I would have to. But I don't think, chemically speaking, it's doing anything. Metaphysically speaking, I mean, it's like having a ready-to-go, already stabilized crystal elixir. So, you know, do with that information what you will. But I don't think filtering it through, the sediment in vodka is not enough to get caught inside Herkimer diamonds, you know, slipping through the cracks there. We'd need a much finer filter for it to really do much for the quality of the alcohol.
Okay. And the other thing, she said, we talked about this earlier, and I told her I'd try and squeeze it in. When you're working with a pendulum, she said, is it the stone that's supposed to be at the bottom, or do you hold the stone and let the chain do the reading? I know how I do it, but I could be wrong.
So the simplest version of any pendulum is just a weight on a string or chain. So you hold the free end and the weight dangles. And that's what the origin of a pendulum was. They were originally like measurement tools for ordinary things. So nowadays, you usually have something affixed to both ends. So maybe like a pointy crystal at one end and a blob-shaped crystal at the other, and you would hold the blob-shaped crystal so the pointy one can swing freely. And because it's got that point, that sort of directionality to it, it's really easy to tell what direction it's moving in.
Mm-hmm. You know, I am so suspicious of all those gems and stone pendulums that I have now. Really, truly. I think they're all plastic and fake.
They probably aren't. And here's the great thing.
Really?
Good. They're going to work anyway. I've tied a paperclip to a piece of thread and gotten it to work.
I know. Well, that's how in some, my friend, when she grew up in Mexico, she said if they wanted to know what baby's gender was going to be with a pregnant woman, they took a paperclip or something and held it over the stomach, and it said, you know, one way for a boy, one way for a girl. So, yeah, it's kind of an easy form of divination, but and it's been around for a long time. But it's really, really kind of interesting, pendulums in general, and there should be some particular stones that might be better for divination with pendulums because they're informational stones, or you know, they have more of a way of fortune telling in a sense, not fortune telling, but you know what I'm saying, rather than other stones that might be done for healing, might be not done so well for a general question about, you know, is the sky going to be blue tomorrow or something?
Right, yeah. I mean, certainly quartz is your answer. When in doubt, just throw some quartz at the problem, right? It's such a great all-purpose stone, but any stone you've got a deep relationship with, I think, is a really helpful tool. There are plenty that we associate with psychic development, like amethyst and lapis lazuli and apophyllite, that you can get pendulums made from pretty easily these days. So I say use what you love. With enough practice, anything can be a pendulum.
It can. And, you know, I think there's that tick-tock, tick-tock that makes the clock go too fast every hour that you're on. But before we go, because we've got like 2 minutes, I want you to let everybody know about the new book, Flower Essences from the Witch's Garden. How is it coming along and when's it coming out?
Oh, thank you so much for asking. I'm really excited about this because it's like really witchy compared to my other books. I mean, it's right there in the title, right? And you know, people peg me as that rock guy, sometimes the rock and Reiki guy, but I really like plants too. Maybe not to the same degree of intensity as rocks, but plants are great. And flower essences are a form of plant spirit medicine. And this book was my baby that I incubated during the pandemic last year. So it's safely in the hands of the editorial team. We're anticipating a spring or summer release next year. I will probably get some firmer concrete dates over the next couple of months. We're kind of hoping that we might have the pre-order up and open by the end of August. I can't make any promises there, but there's a soft goal that we're trying to work toward for that. Lots of moving pieces that make it happen. So that is safely in progress. And then I'm almost done with the book that's going to come out after that, which we're hoping to have a release date by the end of 2022. And that one doesn't have a formal title yet. But what I can say is it will be a very portable, handy little reference guide to several hundred different crystals.
Wow. Okay. You know, you've got people sitting on pins and needles just waiting for all this. You're just teasing everybody. So give everybody out your website so they can find out more about your books, when they're coming out, when they're not coming out, and also your availability for intuitive readings and Reiki sessions and crystal consultations.
Sure. So, I mean, you can visit me at theluminouspearl.com. In fact, I'm The Luminous Pearl on most things. So if you're a Facebooker, you can find me at facebook.com/theluminouspearl. If you're a TikToker, I'm there now because all the cool kids are, right? and also on Instagram as The Luminous Pearl. I have an ongoing crystal workshop series that I do once a month. I send out recordings if you can't be there live called the Monolith Series. And I'm doing a live seminar on the beryl family, aquamarine and emerald and morganite and so on and so forth this weekend. So you can register for that. Even if you can't be there live, I'll get you a link to listen to the replay. I do a free monthly Reiki share as well. Since I can't be with my Reiki community in person, I've switched to a digital format and I make that free so everyone can join. My next one of those will be in June. And if all that is not on my website, because I'm really bad at updating, just shoot me an email or visit me on social media and I'll give you links to all that. So you're welcome to join me on any of these and the forthcoming new and exciting adventures that are on the horizon.
You've got so many, and we're all anxious, sitting on the edge of our seats. But in the meantime, we'll settle for, you know, having you here and there and you know, teasing us more. So thank you. I really appreciate it. I mean, this is really a necessary topic, and I really look forward to another show suggestion from you.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for such an engaging group chat. Thanks, everyone who's here live listening. I really love it, so thank you all.
Yes, I was going to thank them too, but it's coming from you. It's even better. So until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more Cauldron Stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.